Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Governor Charlie Baker is planning a reopening for Massachusetts. This afternoon, he said to expect the approach for May 18th and beyond to be slow and methodical.
People have gone through a tremendous amount of dislocation and discomfort, lost wages, and a whole bunch of other things to get to the point where the virus has been contained enough and reduced enough that we can actually start to reopen the economy. The last thing we're going to do is reopen it in a way that fires that virus up again.
What do we know about the plan, and how has Governor Baker been handling the crisis? WBUR senior State House reporter Steve Brown has been covering the governor's daily coronavirus briefings all along, and he joins us now on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Steve, you were there today, as you have been. What more did the governor say about plans to reopen?
Well, he's continuing to try to tamp down expectations that everything will reopen on Monday. That's just not going to be the case. We should get a better idea of a timeline on Monday. But as he has said on many occasions, it's not like there's going to be a switch thrown and everything starts up again. Reporters are trying to get him to say which businesses will fall into the first category to reopen or how he plans to lift the stay-at-home advisory. And he wasn't going there. He said he doesn't want to. He wants this to be a deliberate way, and that if he starts leaking out information before the release of the report, people will start up ahead of time. He wants it to go off on Monday, and he wants it to go off on a targeted and phased way.
So how do we square that with, A, the fact that we're coming off the surge, but Monday's pretty soon coming up here, given where we've been over the last 8 weeks. And B, he actually, in fact, has given us a little bit of information already this week, like announcing that there will be phases and what the sort of minimum security or safety standards for businesses will be.
Yeah, I mean, he says everything is dependent on the data. The May 18th has been a target date for a while, and that was based on modeling that indicated that the numbers from the surge will have been in a downward trend for a long enough period of time to begin the process of reopening. The governor says that those numbers have been trending downward, and when you look at seven-day rolling averages, they are heading in the correct direction. I guess the challenge for the governor will be to keep expectations in check and keeping the floodgates from opening.
You know, we carry Governor Baker's daily briefings live here on WBUR. You're, almost always there because they're happening every day. But we hear less about what's happening in the legislature. They're not doing daily briefings from their perspective. Can you bring us up to date? What are they doing on relief, reopening, mitigation, et cetera?
Sure. They've been working on a few things. There are a number of COVID-19 related bills that have been filed by lawmakers. Now, like most bills, many of them will go nowhere, but they are going through the legislative process. The major issue on their plate right now, as it is every spring, is the state budget. They know that there's going to be a huge shortfall because of this shutdown of the economy. Senate President Karen Spilka told me yesterday that there's going to be anywhere between a $4 and $6 billion deficit. Of course, the legislature will likely take up the governor's supplemental budget that he filed yesterday, appropriating $1 billion and to cover the COVID-related costs. However, the governor says that that money will be reimbursed by the feds.
And Steve, is there any opposition to the governor's plans or how he's been handling things so far within the legislature?
Yeah, a handful of the more conservative members of the House came out yesterday urging the governor to move more quickly with reopening the economy. I think they are outliers, and their opposition will be dutifully noted by the governor and then ignored.
Okay. I said a second ago, you know, the governor's doing these daily press briefings. How unusual is that, Steve? It seems de rigueur now, but is it a big deal or really unusual for Governor Baker to be speaking with the press every day like this?
Not really. I've been expecting that because, this is probably the biggest thing that we've really lived through news-wise. a huge pandemic. We've never seen anything the likes of this. He's been holding these briefings pretty much every day since March 15th. He had them sporadically before then, every other, couple of days. But then March 15th, that's pretty much when the rubber hit the road here with this. And so he's been having a briefing every day. Lately, he's been taking off the weekends, at least from the public briefing. I'm sure he's still working at home on Saturdays and Sundays, but we just don't see him out in public. There were some days early on in this when there was always big information coming out every day about school and business closings, testing, all sorts of other things going on that were big news. There will be briefings now when there's not a lot of news coming out of it, to be honest. And I jokingly refer to those as Charlie Baker's greatest hits when he reiterates the important information that we should already know. Stay 6 feet apart, cover your face, wash your hands, that sort of thing. I think part of it is the governor's people want to get him in front of the cameras every day to show that he's handling everything. And of course, the media wants to get him in front of the microphones to answer the many, many questions that we have every day.
So let's stay on that for a second. You are a veteran statehouse reporter, and the governor does take a lot of questions, and he seems to have a good rapport with the press corps, calls people by name, sometimes even gives Netflix recommendations. On Monday, out of Washington, we saw the president end a press availability and walk out after an exchange with a reporter. How do you compare and contrast those approaches and relationships?
Yeah, I think there is a respect between the media and the governor that doesn't exist in Washington. Now, I can see sometimes that he gets agitated by some of the questions that we ask, but he's savvy enough to know that that's our job. We're there to get the truth, and we're not there as cheerleaders. We reporters are often frustrated when he doesn't fully answer our questions. He's very skilled at pivoting away from the crux of the question and then settling into some talking points that he has stored away in his head. But I do sense that we're all operating from the same set of facts, and that's a good thing. Sometimes I don't think that's always the case in Washington.
Well, that's WBUR Senior Statehouse Reporter Steve Brown. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tiziana.
As Massachusetts looks toward at least the beginning of a reopening next week, questions remain about what our new normal is going to look like. Some of the biggest are around childcare, especially as schools remain closed for the rest of the academic year and non-emergency childcare remains closed until June 29th. Let's tackle that question today. How and when childcare reopens? Parents, families, how are you thinking about it? How are you thinking about childcare for you going forward? Can you work without it? Are you worried about sending your kids back to a daycare for health and safety reasons? If you're a childcare provider, how have these past couple months been for you? And will you be able to get back up and running? Call us with your thoughts, your stories, your worries. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, joining us to help with this conversation is Amy O'Leary, director of the Early Education for All campaign at Strategies for Children, which is an advocacy and policy organization that works to ensure that Massachusetts invests resources for all children. Amy, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me today.
So, Amy, non-emergency childcare has been closed in the Commonwealth since March 23rd. How have things been going for providers and families since then? That's a long time.
That is a long time. And I think first what I want to acknowledge is that Massachusetts, the governor, working alongside with the commissioner of early education and care, closed childcare. Many states never made the choice to close childcare. So with closing childcare and then opening in emergency sites, we are seeing an opportunity as we think about reopening, about what it looks like to reopen stronger than we were before. We know that families are having an experience from working remotely with young children around, their school-age children around. We also know that programs are working so hard to think about how they stay connected to families while dealing with the many financial realities that are stressing them out and keeping them up at night about what this could look like in the future.
So we do know that we're expecting some kind of staggered or phased reopening, but this is an interesting staggering because businesses, some of them, that have been closed so far could be opening as early as sometime next week. But childcare writ large isn't scheduled to resume until June 29th. And it's not clear how the emergency childcare operations that are open now will serve people in the interim. And schools are closed for the rest of the year. We know that matters for people going to work. How's this going to work?
We sent a letter to the Governor's Reopening Advisory Board talking about, we had 38 organizations sign on, from PNC Bank and the Mass Business Roundtable to the Boston Foundation and MIRA, the Mass Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition, and many early education programs. And our basic message was that there's no way that we can reboost or restart our economy if employees and families don't have access to safe, affordable, high quality childcare. Strategies for Children did a parent survey. We launched it on April 20th. And as of May 1st, we had really interesting results to see. We know that parents are working remotely. We know that parents are relying on information from their childcare providers about when they're going to reopen. We know that folks are very concerned about health and safety, the cleaning that may well have to happen. If there's reduced ratios, who is going to decide who gets to be in programs? And we also know that families are really thinking about health concerns as they think about going back into a program, both for their children and their families. We have learned lessons from the emergency childcare programs. So when, having the social distancing rules in effect, we're still seeing families that have been impacted or testing positive, programs having to close for 2 weeks and then maybe reopening. So this cycle, I think what you mentioned about there's going to be a staggered approach. It's not going to be a light switch. There's also a real financial challenge right now. If you think about reducing the number of children in a program, many of our financial models are based on full enrollment. And we know that's not going to be possible. So there's a lot of fear and anxiety about how providers will think about, supporting the children, supporting the families, and making it economically. There have been estimations nationally about all the numbers of programs that we're going to close.
Parents and families, how about you? Can you sustain work over the long term without bringing your children to childcare? Are you working now and need childcare now? Are you concerned about health and safety when you go back to work or when you bring your children back to childcare? Or has this whole thing changed your calculus on who stays home, who works, and who cares for the children? Call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amy, we talk a lot about the logistics of childcare, the need for working families for childcare. But as with primary school education, we also know that childcare serves really important roles in terms of social emotional development, gross motor skills, other things that are important for kids. What are families losing when children don't have that supplemental support in childcare?
It's interesting that you raise that because I would say that's what we're hearing more of most recently. We know that any survey or any interview with parents, it's evolving, right? As new realities are setting in, I think what they're thinking is changing daily, sometimes hourly and by the minute. We're hearing anecdotally this week that more people are hearing from their employers about potential that they're going to be working from home. And I think that's why we're hearing, for a longer period of time. And I think that reality and thinking about how do you provide adequate socialization, which we know is so important in the early years. How do you make sure your children are meeting these developmental milestones? We know how quickly the brain is developing during this time. But we also know that this is an equity issue. And, people who have to go back to work who aren't going to have many choices, whether it's shift work or thinking of, they're going to have to take the hours they can get. How are employers really working with their employees to better understand what they want and need? We've often talked about the issue of scheduling and having stable schedules. One recommendation we've been thinking about is parents of young children who have to go back to work, they should be first in line in getting schedules that connect to a stable schedule for their early education and care program. But I think the social we're grappling with this as adults. Oh, go ahead.
No, just go ahead and finish that thought and then I want to bring another voice in.
Sure. I was just going to say that as adults, we are grappling with this social and emotional challenge of being socially distant. And I think we're hearing from families on one hand, about how resilient they are. But then, as a New York Times headline for the editorial this week said, we're sick of asking kids to be resilient. So how do we have that balance? And how do we make sure that families are getting the support that they need to support their young children?
So I want to bring another provider voice in. Amy, stay there, please. We have with us Sandy Emery, who runs Sandy's Tiny Tykes in Haverhill. Welcome to Radio Boston, Sandy.
Thank you.
So, Sandy, under normal circumstances, give us an idea of your business. How many children do you take care of?
I have a capacity of 6. I generally have 4 to 5 in my daycare on a daily basis. We start up first thing at 6:30 in the morning. I have people driving in, and I have children leaving between 4:30 and 5 o'clock at night.
And how have the past couple months been for you?
Very quiet. We've been shut down since March 23rd. Of course, as you know, and it's been very quiet, very nerve-wracking. I would definitely have to agree with the anxiety, because we just don't know what it's going to look like come June 29th. If we reopen, there's potential there that might be extended. It possibly could, or we might even lose families. So just the fear of whether or not we're going to be opening up as business as usual, the new standard, because what we were 3 months ago, 4 months ago, is not what it's going to look like when we open up on June 29th or the beginning of July. So things are going to have to change.
Sandy,
so,
Do you have any sense of what you think it might look like? Any sense in your networks of what the requirements might be?
So there's a lot of chitter chatter, and I know that the EEC, the early education and care folks, are putting together what that model is definitely going to look like. They're still working on that. But from what we're hearing, it sounds like our capacity might change. So where I can have 6, I might only be able to have 4. It really depends on what your layout is and your square footage is. And what is it going to look like when these children come in the morning? Well, I can tell you the parents are not going to be coming in the home. They're going to drop outside for sure. Before they used to come in, they might be able to talk. My other children would go up to the other family members and say hello, because as an in-home family daycare, family is the key. We were like a gigantic family here. And that's going to have to slow down, because we're going to have to put that barrier to make sure everybody is safe, because there's so much we don't know right now.
So, Sandy, let's have you stay on the line. I'm going to bring Amy O'Leary back on to Director of Early Education for All campaign. And I want to take a call now. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Jen on the line from Holliston. Hi, Jen. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I have 3 young children. This is an issue that's obviously very relevant to me personally and my family. And I am far more concerned about the long-term impacts of my child not returning to her daycare center than I am, honestly, about health and safety concerns. I know that our center will do everything they need to do to clean and keep children safe, and I am far more concerned about the lack of social interaction, the lack of preparation for kindergarten that my daughter is currently missing, because she is home with a family where the adults are trying to work and the older kids are trying to do schoolwork, and it's very, very difficult. So
it sounds tough.
I would be all for opening as soon as possible.
So Sandy, Amy, is that what you're hearing from other families? Thank you, Jen, for the call. Is that what you're hearing from other families? Are you hearing those same themes that we're hearing from Jen?
I am. With my daycare, every one of my families that I currently have that are going to be coming back are stating that they're ready to go right now. If I said tomorrow the doors are opening up, XYZ is the rules, they said they would all meet by the rules, whatever they would be, just so they could have that social interaction, because Jen's absolutely correct. Those children get to know each other, they get to play, and children learn from one another because they're down on their level. You know, us adults can get down on their level, but the little ones, they learn to walk from one another. It's like having an older brother, they teach one another. And so them missing out on that is very, you know, it could have long-term effects, like when they go off to kindergarten or preschool or somewhere else down the road. It's so much better for their social skills.
Yeah, Sandy, Emery.
Go ahead, Amy.
I would agree. I would agree. And I would also say, I think it changes. Like many of us are going through this psychosis of like, I think everything is going to be okay to, oh my God, nothing's ever going to be the same again. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're also hearing from the programs is the anxiety and liability. And what if someone gets sick and they're in my program? And what if I'm following behind a child and sanitizing the best I can? You know, just how do you support an early education and care workforce that already was undervalued and undercompensated? Mm-hmm. And then, and we know that parents cannot fill in the gap that might happen if we have lower ratios or lower class sizes. So we are going to need public dollars to help solve this problem. And we're going to have to spend them in a different way. Our model has been about, you know, per child, per day in attendance. And we're going to have to revamp and rethink a lot of that. I think the best partnership between parents and providers right now and keeping those lines of communication and being able to be frustrated together are so critical.
So, Amy, I'm going to ask you to continue to stay right there, please. Sandy Emery, who runs Sandy's Tiny Talks, Tots. I'm so sorry. I cannot say that today. It is Sandy's Tiny Tykes. It's a lovely name. I'm sorry, Sandy. In Haverhill, I appreciate you joining us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, and I do want to bring in one other voice on this. This is Emma LaVecchia, who is one of the co-founders of Pine Village Preschools, which operates 10 locations throughout the greater Boston area. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Emma, let me ask you quickly, how many families do you serve across those 10 locations, or did you before the shutdown?
We served about 475 families with about 500 children.
And how many employees?
About 125. Including admin staff. So we have about 115 school dedicated teachers and directors.
And what have been the financial implications for you and your employees? Did you receive financial assistance? Have you been able to continue to pay them?
So when we actually shut down on March 13th was our last day. We continued to pay staff for the month of March. With the original understanding that we were only going to be closed for 2 weeks. And obviously that changed over those 2 weeks. We are very grateful that we received PPP funds. It's sort of our lifeline right now. We, after those 2 weeks, made the very difficult decision to furlough all of our staff. And they are still currently furloughed. When we found out that we were not going to be allowed to open until June 29th and sort of looked at the implications of using the PPP funds completely before we were even allowed to open and resume, you know, work and receiving revenue. It just wasn't a responsible way to use those funds. So we do have a very limited staff now, kind of online doing some admin work in finance and enrollment, but all of our school staff are furloughed.
And I do just want to note the PPP is the Payroll Protection Program, which was part of the Federal CARES Act. One other question for you, Emma, are you confident? What level of confidence do you have? That might be a better way to ask the question, that your business and your staff are going to be able to come back after this and that your families will bring their children back too.
So it's sort of this like a cycle, and all of these things kind of have to work out and have to come together for us to be able to resume as we were before. And we won't resume as we were before, but I'm very confident that Pine Village will be able to open up when we're allowed to. We are going to look very different. We've already begun surveying our families to find out what their intentions are for summer and for the fall. And everything that Amy and Sandy have said is completely true. Parents have, you know, they sort of fall into three buckets. Some families are concerned with the health and safety and really want to stay home until they feel more confident. Some are just unsure, and some can't wait to come back. And the minute that we're open, they're going to bring their kids. We're kind of looking at the summer as a soft opening with a limited number of kids and a limited number of staff, depending on how many children come back, and really just trying to meet the needs of what our families are looking for. We're also
I want to bring Amy back.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, if you don't mind, Emma, we've got a couple of minutes left, and there are a few other subjects I want to get to. I want to bring Amy back into the conversation, and I want to talk to both of you. We talked about PPP, which is the Payroll Protection Program, but there is another issue, and it relates back to the developmental conversation we were having before, mm-hmm. which is PPE, personal protective equipment. The fact that children over the age of 2, I'm assuming we'll be required to wear that in childcare. The staff will be required to wear that. I've talked to a lot of families. My children are older, but I've talked to a lot of families with younger children who talk about the fact that the PPE scares their kids and creates this sense of barrier. How do we think about something like PPE and social distancing requirements in the act of providing a nurturing childcare environment? Amy, I think I'll start with you, and then I'll go back over to Emma.
Sure. As I have been thinking, before I was a full-time advocate, I was a preschool teacher and director for 10 years, and which is why my heart is with the people who are trying to help think about, to run programs. I think that we're going to have to rely on the innovation and the creativity and just the can-do attitude of early educators and school-age providers, because I think, like anything else, they're going to have to think about ways to teach this, ways to make it fun, ways that people understand the rules. It's the same way that we think about learning how to share, standing in line, all the kind of executive function pieces that we talk about when we think about high quality early ed. It's going to be the same conversations. And I think they're going to rely on partnership with families. And they're going to, we often have to explain things to children that we don't understand as adults. So I believe that there will be an adjustment. And I think there'll be kind of peaks and valleys and highs and lows of how it's going. But I think, we will be in a new reality. And I think that we'll, early educators will find a way.
Emma, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I totally agree. And we've actually been spending the last month talking about the transition back to school and how to support our families and the kids emotionally when they come back, because they've been through a trauma, staying at home, isolated at home, being dragged out of their regular everyday routine is really traumatizing. And coming back to a school environment all together, which is going to be completely unfamiliar, is going to be traumatizing. So we've already started discussing things like having tags with the all of our teachers are going to be very familiar to the kids, but having pictures like name tags for each teacher with their full face on it so that kids can see their faces even though they're covered up. Doing some Zoom calls with the kids, with the teachers already having masks on so they get used to seeing them in masks. We've talked about fun ways for kids to decorate their own masks, maybe using superhero hats and incorporating the masks with them. So, everything is going to be very different. And it is our top priority of all early educators to make this transition smooth and support these kids emotionally when they come back to school. Because as much as September is a big transition for kids, this returning is going to be a big one. And none of us have gone through it before. We're, as we say 100 times, we're building the airplane as we're flying. So we're going on our instinct and trusting what's right and what we know is most important for the kids.
That's Emma LaVecchia, one of the co-founders of Pine Village Preschools, which operates 10 locations throughout Greater Boston. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you.
And Amy O'Leary, director of the Early Education for All campaign at Strategies for Children, which is a policy and organizing organization. Amy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, and thanks for covering this important issue.
The coronavirus pandemic has changed the rhythm of our daily lives in so many ways, from work to childcare, as we just talked about before the break, and even what we wear. The clothes that we choose and why we choose them can reveal a lot about the cultural moment that we're in. And as we embrace some long-term changes in how we live, we want to talk now about how this pandemic is changing our fashion. Now, I did not have any masks in my closet or in the mitten basket by the door at this time last year. How about you? Call us and let us know how things are changing for you. How has your fashion changed? Or how are you thinking differently about fashion in the last few months? Wearing the same stuff you used to when you work? And we're also going to talk about masks. How do you feel about masks? Are masks becoming a way that you express yourself? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We have two people joining us to have this conversation. The first is Erin Robertson. She's a Boston-based fashion designer and the winner of Project Runway Season 15. Erin, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here today.
Glad to have you. And we also have Kimberly Alexander, who teaches museum studies, material culture, and American history at the University of New Hampshire. Kimberly, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So I'm glad to have you. Erin, I'm going to start with you. You call yourself a fashion scientist on your Instagram. What does that mean?
Well, I have like a bit of an issue with just being a fashion designer because I don't think it quite represents the sort of like intent that I put into all of my clothing. I have a lot of knowledge embedded. Just sometimes it's very obvious and sometimes it's a little bit more secretive and you have to look a little bit deeper or read about why I do something. And so that's part of it. And so there's a lot of research that I actually put into a lot of my work. And the sort of more obvious side is I'm super into the future of fashion and how technology is going to really change that. So an example is I've worked with Jifei Wu out of the MIT Media Lab, where we created a 3D printed fur coat. And using his technology, which I won't go into too much just because I don't think there's enough time, and then merging that with my design, we were able to make this, we made a few coats now. Out of this, his 3D printed technology, and it feels just like fur. So
that's exciting. Sort
of where I come from.
and Kimberly Alexander, tell us what it means to teach about material culture. What is material culture?
Well, material culture is essentially any object that's created by human hands. But what makes it so exciting, at least for me, is the study of the stories that go along with the objects, whether they're objects in museums or objects in your home, or even, as we'll be discussing today, objects that you put on your body.
So let's talk about that a little bit. If we think about fashion, Erin and Kimberly, in terms of what we put on our body and what that tells us, what story that tells, what story do you think the fashion transition we're going through right now is telling? Erin, how about you?
Well, I'm a big fan, and sort of my idea of fashion is that it's an extended phenotype of our identities. So I think that what I'm really noticing is almost sort of there's this super comfort of I'm buying sweatpants, leggings, like to the 10th degree, where it's just that's the sort of like normal life now. But then there's also for me, what I get really excited about is I think this is also like a great opportunity to sort of push the boundaries of the way that you sort of like see yourself. So I think a lot of people are afraid to try color or afraid to try maybe a different shape on their body or maybe be a little bit more feminine or masculine or try a new trend that they were always afraid to do. But I think that now you kind of have this time to try it out, maybe in the comfort of your own home, maybe post it on Instagram or TikTok and see how it works rather than going out and like being vulnerable, like on the T or, you know, getting mocked or thinking that you're going to get mocked. But I think it's a really exciting time to actually try something new.
And Kimberly, when somebody teaches about material culture 100 years from now and looks back at this part of this moment, right, these early days, what do you think that they're going to say about what's happening for us culturally?
Well, actually, I'll just, I had an anecdote. The last day that we had in-person classes, I had two young female students come up to me and they said, do you think this will be studied 100 years from now, what we're going through right now? And I said, absolutely. So start your journals and creativity projects. I think it's a little bit difficult to say right at the moment when we're in it, where things will end up and how they might be studied. But I wanted to sort of tie back into something that Erin said, because if you look back in time, and I've been spending a good bit of my research looking at the 1918 influenza, and particularly also gender issues related to how masks were worn, how they were designed, and how they were written about, one of the things that strikes me, it ties in with Erin's idea of the creativity. We don't tend to think of a lot of perhaps creativity in mask making when you look back at the photos that we have of 1918. But if you start looking at some of the drawings in people's diaries and their journals, even announcements from different newspapers, there's a real focus on individuality, on people picking masks that were part of their persona. And so one of my favorite sort of cartoons shows an elegant woman with a hat and a veil. And so I've been looking a lot at the way women used veils, both in a sort of distancing, social distancing way about the influenza, but also maybe about unwanted gazes from onlookers when you're out and about more. Or the gentleman who designs his mask theoretically with a hole for the cigar he can't stop smoking, you know, and then you know,
love that.
Puffing away through his mask. Or if you think of some of our masks today, you've got designers like Louis Vuitton, you've got most alumni associations of universities doing their own masks. You have a lot of really diligent home crafters and designers creating masks. And I came across this image of a mask, again, it's a cartoon, but that says, to hell with the Kaiser, right on the mask. So you're
right on the mask.
Right on the mask. So you're again, it's that projection of self in a way that I think in 1918, we would not necessarily have expected.
So we've got a caller who I think will weigh in on this projection of self idea. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We want you to join the conversation. What are you thinking about in terms of what you're wearing? Has it changed? Are you finding ways to express yourself, or are you feeling overwhelmed by things like face masks and sort of the lack of need to wear your best stuff out? We've got John on the line from Newton. John, go ahead.
Hi, I am a grocery delivery driver. I have my own business. I've been doing orders nonstop since this began. And I did Instacart for about a year before this. And I often wore long socks and shorts because it made me feel faster in the store. I sort of rushed around, felt sleeker with the long socks on. And I've been sort of going through a personal renaissance lately. So, you know, fashion choices are becoming something that I'm thinking about more. And as my business has grown, I'm sort of able to afford it a little more, you know, get a whole bunch of different socks and some brighter colors. Part of it, I think, is to help people improve their moods. You know, one of the things that I love about this work is that when I show up at someone's house with a pile of groceries, they're delighted. And it brings me joy. So to show up in colorful stuff, it's fun. And I think it's sort of the highlight of some people's day. You know, they stay inside all day long, and then I show up with food, and it's a highlight. So I want to feel that way for them.
Stay with us, because I heard Aaron react to you in the background there, and I just want to give Aaron a chance to talk to you for a minute. Aaron, go ahead.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I love that you are realizing that, like, the color brings joy, because for me and my brand and what I do is I'm, like, a very colorful person, and I think that it's, like, a beautiful way to express yourself, and I think that in wearing colors and kind of, like, pushing yourself, it also inspires other people, because everyone's at their own, like, everyone's at a different journey in their personal style. So some people are, like, waiting to be able to come out with their colorfulness. So I think that's, like, so beautiful that you, like, you know, the joy is really important right now.
Oh, thanks. The other thing that happens, my face mask is a pattern that's a dog whistle to fans of the band Fish with a PH. And I'll be running around the store, and the meat guy at Whole Foods will be like, "Oh, hey, you know, it's too bad they had to postpone summer tour," and you know, we'll bond over that, and like, you know, it's become sort of part of my identity. And actually, one of the other I work for a different company than Instacart, and one of the other shoppers recognized me from my picture on the internet the other day based on that buff. That I wear around my face.
That's great.
So, John, thanks so much for that call. I appreciate it. And for kind of giving us a glimpse into the way that we communicate with each other through fashion. Kimberly, obviously, John talked again about his mask there and the sense that he is actually signaling kind of community. Hey, I'm a guy who likes fish. It invites other people to engage with him, even though, of course, with that mask on, you can't see his eyes very well, or, you know, you can't get those same facial expressions. You don't know if he's smiling. So as you say, masks can really be, I mean, we're going to have to wear them. So they can be a way to invite sense of community and belonging with each other, even though they're really a barrier. Is that right?
Well, one of the things about the idea of color and pattern and smiles and all of that is I do think you can still tell if someone's smiling because of the way their eyes crinkle up when you smile. But I think color, you know, it's the first thing someone's going to notice on your face. And I have a number of friends who are costumers and designers in addition to Aaron, but who are now choosing their daily mask, right? So which one are they going to wear today? Are they feeling like they want to wear a blue toile or, you know, a bright yellow, imperial yellow kind of silk or whatever type of mood they might be in, something that resembles a quilt or a calico textile. I almost imagine some of these very talented colleagues having a whole array of masks and having them each on a hook for a different day, you know, day of the week, or your mood masks.
Definitely.
Erin, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I'm like over here. I wish you could see my head. I'm like shaking it. Cause I've been making masks since March 21st. And primarily I've been making masks for, frontline workers, ranging from like nurses, doctors, janitors, like homeless, like anyone that's been needing them. And over the past like few weeks, I've been developing, sort of like this identity with masks. Cause you know, before I wasn't making masks, and now I've created this mask that has a bow. So you tie it behind and wrap it around a bun, and it's just super feminine and cute and a way to be again, playful. And then I have art masks where I've reached out to a couple local artists as well as my dad, and I got their art printed on fabric and made them like a little bit chicer, and some of the proceeds go to the artist to support them during this time. But then also the person who buys it, they can feel super unique with this like custom fabric. And then like this other mask that I've been working on, which has been my favorite, is out of Ripstop, which is like a waterproof, breathable material. And that one I'm making a bit sportier and definitely, I would say, probably more gender neutral. And this one, I'm super excited about the development of it because it's not cotton. It has cotton lining, but the outside is, like I said, waterproof. So, and since like COVID travels through the vapor, and again, like we don't know the specific droplet sizes, but I'm really excited about this one. So
that sounds great.
I'd love to pick up another call here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've got Malika on the line from Roxbury. Malika, please go ahead.
Hi, I'm originally from Michigan, moved here in January. By way of Ohio, and I'm a 70 years old archaeologist, U of M grad, a designer.
Go blue.
My son calls me fabric leather wood mechanic on Instagram, and everybody thought I was weird because in the Midwest, you know, I was wearing all my own clothing, my own designs, and all of that. And I've been wearing the mask, and I come here for 11 years because of the smog. Now my son says, "Mommy, all my friends say, where's your mother? We thought she was crazy. For 40-something years, she's been carrying around baggies with alcohol or bleach on them and wipes and go bags and emergency stuff and first aid stuff. And now, and she wipes off the shoes and makes us wipe off the, you know, the groceries. Everything she's been doing for 40-something years is now in. And we thought you were crazy." Well, I'm like, thank you, son. Okay.
So, Malika, you weren't crazy. You were just ahead of your time. And so thank you for that call, Malika. And we love you for being ahead of your time, because it's true. A bunch of the stuff you were doing certainly does not look crazy now. How do we put kind of being ahead of the curve in the context here around the pandemic, the things that are changing, even things, Erin and Kimberly, like companies that went casual a few years ago and now suddenly everyone's in sweatpants because you're not in front of each other anymore. You know, how do we think about these curves and what the next curve is going to be?
I you know, my thing is, I really think there's going to be like up two ends of the polls. Like, I think that they're going to have like ultra comfort. And then there's still going to be a need to want to dress up because, you know, there is social media. So, you know, we can't discredit the fact that we're going to be online. And so that will still be a thing. So I don't know. I think that it's going to be a high and a low. Like, there may not be like too much of a middle.
I agree.
Kimberly, how about you?
Very much, because I think we're sort of starting to see what we wear more, maybe as you say, in sort of polar ends of expressions of ourselves. So, you know, there's the all black, you know, joggers and whatever you wear during the day, and then something that you'll wear if you're, you know, even getting together with family for a graduation event. You know, my niece graduated from Penn State over the weekend, and almost everybody got dressed up and actually put on, you know, makeup, earrings, nice clothes, probably for most of us the first time in a couple months. but there was something about the occasion, even though it was via Zoom, that it made it special. And I think you'll continue to see that because people will be, you know, anxious to show that.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it's also, I mean, I love dressing up because I love being super lazy and wearing a double XL t-shirt and sneakers. But then I love to also, you know, just be ridiculous and put on makeup because it kind of builds a self-esteem and makes you feel good about yourself. So, I mean, I've always dressed for myself anyways. So I feel like, at least for me, I'm kind of hoping that people start realizing that the reason to dress up and to put on makeup and to find cute clothes is really for yourself. It's never been for anyone else.
Right. That's right.
So Erin and Kimberly, we've got 1 minute left of content here. And the last thing I want to ask you is, people are experiencing financial hardship. So how does one do fashion when you don't have a lot of money or you might really be hurting financially? Just briefly, Kimberly, what's
really,
your thought?
Oh, okay.
I think that one of the things that that we've all always done and probably will see more of is using vintage, using secondhand. You know, even some of the big companies now have an entire site, part of their site where you can buy vintage, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s, even early 2000s items. I also think this is...
I'm sorry, Kimberly. Actually, I appreciate that second thought, but I've got less than a minute, so I want to give Erin a chance to answer
right.
that one, too.
Go ahead, Erin.
I totally agree with Kimberly. Secondhand's amazing. My thing is, I really, and I hope, people get more excited about making more things and get inspired to create their own stuff.
That was
and
exactly
is there a fabric everybody has at home, Erin, that you say, hey, turn to your closet and look for this fabric?
Cotton is the easiest thing to work with. And I would say to start there and then you can grow.
All right. That is Erin Robertson. She's a Boston-based fashion designer and winner of the Project Runway season 15. Erin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Kimberly Alexander, who teaches museum studies, material culture, and American history at the University of New Hampshire. This has been fun. Thank you, Kimberly.
Thank you so much.